and I have never felt so empowered in my life. Later, I looked up that verse about God's strength being a perfect match for my weakness. But He, Jesus, said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weakness, so that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses, in insults, in hardships, in persecutions, in difficulties. For when I am weak, then I am strong." 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 9 through 10. God's power is made perfect in weakness. This stirs my heart. Weakness is hard, but weakness doesn't have to mean defeat. It is my opportunity to experience God's power firsthand. Had I said yes to that one bite the first night of our vacation, there would have been more compromises. Compromise built upon compromise equals failure. Instead, resisting temptation allowed promise upon promise to be built up in my heart, and that creates empowerment. This is God's power working through my weakness. I knew one day I would be empowered enough to take a couple of bites and walk away, but that day had not yet come. I don't know what you might be struggling with today, but I can assure you that God is fair and just. There is a good reason we must face our temptations. The struggle to say no may be painful in the moment, but it's working out something magnificent within us. For so long, I've considered my struggles with weight a curse. The thought that this isn't fair doesn't happen only on vacation. It also happens when I watch my size 2 friend eating handfuls of French fries and chocolate chip cookies while I'm eating yet another salad. How fair is that? Have you ever felt this way? We aren't alone. Listen to what some of my blog friends say when I ask them about the "it's not fair" issue. I have a skinny sister who can lose at the drop of a dime and does. It always baffled me. I wonder if her DNA got all the family's willpower and high metabolism. It's very hard being the fattest in the family, Jessica. How many times have I said this exact thing to my friends? Why do I struggle with this? Why can't I struggle with something else? How I've begged for God to remove this thorn from me. Yet, it's still there, and I'm still here struggling, Lindsay. Thank you for acknowledging this very real struggle. You're right. There are many way worse things in this world. But this is still really hard for some of us, like me. I have even found myself jealous of other people's less visible struggles. I've wished that instead of being hooked on food, I could be hooked on cigarettes or alcohol. What? I know that's ridiculous, but in my weakest, saddest, most frustrated moments, I believe the lie that everyone else, even people struggling with really hard things, have it better than me. Mary. But what if this battle with food isn't the curse we've always thought it to be? What if it's actually the very thing, if brought under control, that can lead us to a better understanding of God? What if we could actually get to the place where we thank God for letting us face this battle because of the rich treasures we discovered on the battlefield? My friend E. Titus sums up what I'm discovering as well. When I get all caught up in how unfair it is that my friend is skinny and doesn't have to work at it, how she can eat what she wants when she wants, and how much it stinks that I can't be like her, I remind myself that God didn't make me to be her. You see, He knew even before I was born that I could easily allow food to be an idol in my life, that I would go to food instead of to Him to fulfill my needs. And in His great wisdom, He created my body so that it would experience the consequences of such a choice, so that I would continually be drawn back into His arms. He wants me to come to Him for fulfillment, emotional healing, comfort. And if I could go to food for that and never gain an ounce, well then, what would I need God for? There is such wisdom in my friend's perspective. Instead of parking her brain in a place where she constantly feels a struggle with food and weight issues, she's chosen a much healthier perspective. The reality is, we all have things in our lives we have to learn to surrender, give up, sacrifice, turn away from. Back to my vacation example. Yes, my husband could eat all the desserts he wanted, but he has other areas in which he has to learn how to depend on God. Think of that skinny girl in your life who you've watched eating whatever she wants and thought how unfair that is. She may not struggle with her weight, but trust me, she has struggles. An anonymous comment on my blog gave vulnerable witness to this reality. I'm one of the skinny girls, but don't mistake skinny for healthy. I battle depression and starvation, fight self-esteem issues from years of verbal abuse. The list seems endless. Little is just an image. But being little doesn't make a person more happy or faithful or joyful. The struggles are the same, or at least similar, just in a different size package. Life as a Christ follower will always be a learning process of depending less on her own strength and more on God's power. The Bible teaches that this testing of our faith develops perseverance, which must finish its work so that we may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. James chapter 1, verses 3 through 4. Oh, sweet sisters, this truth should be the cry of our souls instead of Satan's lie that it's not fair. Our taste buds make such empty claims to satisfy us, but only persevering with God will make us truly full, complete, not lacking anything. Press on, sisters. Press on. Personal Reflections. 1. Recall the last special occasion or celebration you attended. What foods were present that you knew probably weren't good choices for you? If you ate them, how much of your decision was influenced by telling yourself this was a special situation and deserved an exception? If you passed them by, did you nevertheless resent your choice because it didn't seem fair? 2. Temptation doesn't take kindly to being starved. Page 101. Have you ever experienced what it's like to starve temptation in any area of your life? What happened? How did it make you feel? For example, did you feel peaceful and empowered, or like a tug of war was raging in your heart? 3. Lisa says she recognizes that having a pity party is a clue that she's relying on her own strength rather than God's strength. What clues you into the fact that you are relying on your own strength in your battles with food? 4. Have you ever felt as if issues with food and weight were God's unfair curse on you, or wished your struggle could be with something other than food? In what ways might your struggle be beneficial or even a blessing? 5. When facing a moment of indecision about food, Lisa recommends thinking beyond the moment by saying, "This feels good now, but how will I feel about this in the morning?" Thinking back to the last time you ate something you later regretted, do you believe asking yourself this question would have changed your decision? Why or why not? 6. Compromise built upon compromise equals failure. Promise upon promise creates empowerment. Page 104. Some decisions about food may seem inconsequential in the moment, but even small decisions can have a big impact over time. In which direction are your small decisions about food leading? Toward failure or empowerment? 7. The struggle to say no may be painful in the moment, but it is working out something magnificent within us. Page 104. What is the magnificent thing you hope God might do in you through your struggles to say no? Chapter 11. Stinking, rotten, horrible, no good day. I just don't have it in me to stick with this healthy eating thing, Amy quipped in utter exhaustion. Life had been spinning out of control in every area, troubled finances, a stressful marriage, struggling family members, and on and on. Because she couldn't control much about her life, Amy felt she could no longer limit her food choices. Food was her numbing drug of choice. When her bills ran high and her cash flow short, ice cream from her freezer would do the trick. When marriage stresses overwhelmed her emotions and there seemed to be no end to the conflicts, leftover Halloween candy was an easy thing to sneak by the fistfuls. When another bad report came about her dad's cancer, French fries and a chocolate shake soothed her raw nerves. When her house seemed messy, dusty, and chaotic, she escaped to the local coffee shop where a grande, extra whip, triple-shot white chocolate mocha made her life feel smooth and sweet. When her struggling child brought home another failing grade, she decided it was a great day to head off to the Mexican restaurant down the street where they could both get lost in huge bowls of chips and salsa. 47 pounds later, she sat crying on her bathroom floor. "What am I doing to myself?" she sobbed. She'd been carrying the weight of the world on her shoulders, and now everything was compounded by all the weight she'd added to her body. Tears streamed down her cheeks as she crawled into bed and glanced at the photo on her bedside table. There she was, nearly 50 pounds ago, smiling and hugging her husband. Where had that happy girl gone? Where had that happy couple gone? And when was the last time they'd even touched? A deep knot of insecurity twisted in her gut at the thought of her husband seeing her now. More tears. More desperation. More hopelessness. And the only thing she wanted in that moment was the bag of goldfish crackers and the half carton of Oreos sitting in her pantry. Goldfish? Oreos? My life is falling apart and my body's expanding more and more by the minute, and all I can think about right now is goldfish and Oreos? It is a stinking, rotten, horrible, no-good day. Right now would be a really good time for the earth to implode and swallow me up into a dark hole. Or for Jesus to come back. And speaking of Jesus, what an utter disappointment I must be. Amy felt a dark depression slipping over her like a heavy blanket. A blanket so bleak and black she thought it might strangle the life out of her. Ever been there? I have. Isn't it just like Satan to make us think we have to have something to comfort us, fill us, satisfy us, only to be haunted by the consequences of this comfort later? Getting a handle on food during hard times. In the previous chapter, we talked about being tempted during times of celebration. But I think it worth chatting about being tempted to overeat and make poor choices during times of struggle as well. Those times when you just don't have it in you to deny yourself unhealthy foods. Life is already denying you so much. For heaven's sake, everything you want seems out of reach, but these cookies are right here. And you want them. And they will taste good. And no one has the right to say you can't have them, so there. Obviously, I've been around this mountain a time or two, or 27. But I love what my friend Ruth Graham says about traveling around the same mountain for far too long. Either we can be victimized and become victims, or we can be victimized and rise above it. Often, it is easier to play the victim than take off our masks and ask for help. We get comfortable with our victim status. It becomes our identity, and is hard to give up. The Israelites often played the victim card, and I love what God finally tells them. You have circled this mountain long enough. Now turn north. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 3, NASB. Turn north. It's time to move on. Self-pity, fear, pride, and negativity paralyze us. Taking off our masks takes courage, but if we don't do it, we will remain in our victim status and end up stunted. Or in this case, overweight and unhealthy, further compounding our feelings of being victimized by our circumstances. So, what can we do when we don't have the energy or the fortitude or the desire to eat healthy? This is an important thing to tackle because if there is one thing I know about life, it will be dotted with hard times. So, we've got to get a plan to realistically handle them. We've got to get a plan to refuse to head south with our healthy eating plan and keep our compasses set to true north. I love God's command to turn north and stop circling this mountain. And, as Ruth states, an important part of turning north is taking off our masks and asking for help. For me, this starts with taking off my mask before the Lord and asking Him to help me find fulfillment in my relationship with Him. This is hard sometimes. Taking off my mask means I have to admit that there's a problem, and I really don't want to do that. Admitting I have a problem will likely require that I make changes, and changes are hard. Food gives such an instant rush and tangible good feeling. It's so much easier to figure out how to get the short-term high of a cookie than it is to get a heart filled up and satisfied with God. I can drive to the store and fill my arms with any kind of cookies I want, but wrapping my arms around getting filled up with God during a particularly empty feeling day doesn't seem as tangible or immediate. I know I should pray, but I'll be honest again and admit that I'm done with praying fake plastic prayers when I'm struggling. Rote prayers I've repeated thousands of times just won't cut it when unhealthy snack options are calling to me from the pantry and my resolve is worn as thin as a tissue. I've been known to pray as I'm stuffing myself full. God, thank you for this food. Take it to the nourishment of my body. And please change the molecular structure of these goldfish into that of carrot sticks. Since I hardly think that's a sign of taking off my mask, getting honest with God, and heading north, I have to have another prayer strategy. I have to find a way to be filled up and satisfied with God's love. And a few years ago, I found exactly what I needed. Prayers where I don't speak at all. Prayers where I don't speak at all. I had been going through some stinking, rotten, horrible, no-good days and was at the absolute end of knowing what to pray. I'd slipped into a habit of praying circumstance-oriented prayers where I'd list out every problem and ask God to please fix them. I even made suggestions for solutions in case my input could be useful. But nothing changed, except my waistline and the amount of chocolate life suddenly required. In a huff one day, I sat down to pray and had absolutely no words. None. I sat there staring blankly. I had no suggestions. I had no solutions. I had nothing but quiet tears and some chocolate smeared across my upper lip. Eventually, God broke through my worn-out heart. A thought rushed through my mind and caught me off guard. I know you want me to change your circumstances, Lisa, but right now, I want to focus on changing you. Even perfect circumstances won't satisfy you, like letting me change the way you think. I didn't necessarily like what I heard during the first time of silently sitting with the Lord, but at least I felt I was connecting with God. I hadn't felt that in a long time. And so, to keep the connection, I started making it a habit to sit quietly before the Lord. Sometimes I cried. Sometimes I sat with a bad attitude. Sometimes I sat with a heart so heavy I wasn't sure I'd be able to carry on much longer. But as I sat, I pictured God sitting there with me. He was there already. And I eventually sensed that. I experienced what the Apostle Paul taught when he wrote, "In the same way, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. We do not know what we ought to pray for, but the Spirit Himself intercedes for us with groans that words cannot express. Romans chapter 8, verse 26. As I sat in silence, the Spirit interceded with perfect prayers on my behalf. I didn't have to figure out what to pray or how to pray about the situation that seemed so consuming. I just had to be still and sit with the Lord. And during those sitting times, I started to discern changes I needed to make in response to my circumstances, none of which included using food for comfort. I think a lot of us try to get filled up with things or people. In Becoming More Than a Good Bible Study Girl, I talked about how I walked around for years with a little heart-shaped cup, holding it out to other people and things, trying to find fulfillment. Some of us hold out our heart-shaped cup to food. Others demand that husbands love us in ways that right our wrongs and fill up our insecurities. Sometimes we expect our kids to be successful, so we look good and have our worth validated by their accomplishments. Or we overspend our budget on an outfit we just have to have. Whatever it is, if we are really going to stop circling the mountain and head north toward the lasting changes, we have to empty ourselves of the lie that other people or things can ever fill our hearts to the full. Then we have to deliberately and intentionally fill up on God's truths and stand secure in His love. The more I fill myself up with the truths of God's love, the less I find myself pulling out that little heart-shaped cup. I have to mentally replace the lies using some of my favorite verses to remind myself of just how filling God's love really is. Here are some examples of how I do that. Old lie. I need these Oreos. They will fill me up with a chocolate high and taste so good. New truth. The thought that these Oreos will fill me is a lie. They will taste good for just the few minutes it will take to eat them. Then that hollow feeling of guilt will rush in as soon as the chocolate high dissipates. Do I want to eat right now because I need nourishment? Or because I'm feeling empty emotionally or spiritually? If I truly need a snack right now, I am capable of choosing a healthier option. Favorite verse. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have power, together with all the saints, to grasp how wide and how long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. Ephesians chapter 3, verses 17 through 19. Old lie. I am such a failure with this healthy eating thing. Why sacrifice this instant gratification now when I know eventually I'll just go back to my old habits anyhow? New truth. I am not a failure. I am a lavishly loved child of God. Part of my right as a child of God is to operate in a power beyond myself. The Holy Spirit is God's gift to me, so it is possible for me to use the self-control I've been given. Favorite verse. How great is the love the Father has lavished on us, that we should be called children of God. And that is what we are. 1 John chapter 3, verse 1. Old lie. God seems so far away, and French fries are right around the corner at the drive-thru. New truth. French fries don't love me. And the only lasting thing I get from them is the cholesterol and cellulite they inevitably leave behind, which will just compound my frustration. God's love is here in the moment and in many more to come. His love is true and carries with it only positive residual effects. Favorite verse. But from everlasting to everlasting, the Lord's love is with those who fear Him. Psalm chapter 103, verse 17. This is just the start of replacing the lies and rationalizations with the truths of God's love. I encourage you to write out some old lies and new truths on your own. The process of stripping away old lies is hard and can produce raw feelings. That's why it's so crucial to have truths with which to replace them. When I posted a small portion of these thoughts on my blog, I received some very raw and honest responses, but one especially grabbed my heart because Kim is seeing how beneficial replacing old lies with truths can be. She said, "What you wrote today was clearly from God for me to hear. I have lived the last 28 of my 40 years of life trying to get someone to fill me, love me, need me, make me worthy, all in an effort to compensate for the abuse, mental, emotional, and physical, and then complete abandonment of my father, brother, and paternal side of the family. Food? Honey, let me tell you that 350 pounds later, I am finally getting that food is not a substitute for God's love. It's almost destroyed me. My marriage is in shambles. We separated this past Friday. Our 5-year-old daughter is stressed, acting out. You name it, she is there. This is not the life I want. This is not the life I plan to continue to lead. If ever God spoke to me, what you wrote today went right to the heart of the matter. Thank you for being faithful. Thank you, God Almighty, for loving me. I am one step into a future that has real hope, hope that God fulfills." I pray we are all with Kim on this journey of replacing lies, embracing truth, and learning that food was never meant to fulfill the deepest places of our hearts reserved for God alone. Not on the good days, not on the bad days, and not even on the stinking, rotten, horrible, no-good days. God says, "See, I have placed before you an open door that no one can shut." Revelation chapter 3, verse 8. May it be that we walk through that door, head north, and never look back. Personal Reflections. 1. Recall a recent stressful experience that tempted you to overeat or make poor food choices. What specific feelings did the experience elicit? For example, anger, embarrassment, tension, sadness, anxiety, grief? Whether you resisted or gave in to temptation, how were your emotions impacted as a result? 2. When you experience problems or difficult seasons in life, are you more likely to put on a mask and pretend everything is okay, or to take off your mask and ask for help? How has this tendency impacted your ability to resist food temptations at such times? 3. Discovering how to pray without words helped Lisa to feel like she was connecting with God, something she hadn't felt in a long time. Page 113. Have you ever prayed this way, simply spending time with God in silence and allowing the Holy Spirit to intercede on your behalf? Romans chapter 8, verse 26. Does this idea intrigue you or scare you? 4. Lisa demonstrates how she replaces old lies about food with new truths about God's love. Page 114. In the course of a regular day, what old lies about food make it difficult for you to resist temptation? Do hard times make these lies harder to resist? Drawing on what the Bible teaches about God's love in Ephesians chapter 3, verses 17 through 19, 1 John chapter 3, verse 1, and Psalm chapter 103, verse 17, what new truths might you use to replace your old lies? 5. See, I've placed before you an open door that no one can shut. Revelation chapter 3, verse 8. If God were to speak these words directly to you about your struggles with food, what do you hope you would see and experience on the other side of the door? Chapter 12. The Curse of the Skinny Jeans. In the last chapter, we talked about sticking to our healthy eating plan during times when rotten days try to throw us off kilter. Once I reached my goal weight, I thought I'd never really have those off-kilter days again. I mean, really, what could possibly trouble me if I could fit into my skinny, thought I would never wear them again, jeans? Boy, was I wrong. It should have been a week of absolute rejoicing. I'd reached a major mile marker in my healthy eating journey. Results! Tangible, amazing, thought I might never see this day, results! My skinny jeans fit. I was not only able to get them pulled all the way up and buttoned, but I could still breathe. Oh, yes, ma'am. I could breathe and move and even sit down without the fear of busting the seams. Have you ever known this kind of crazy? Like most women, I had kept this pair of skinny jeans in my closet. They had made it through many, many closet purges. All of my other jeans from a size I hadn't seen in quite a while had long since been bagged up and taken to Goodwill. But this particular pair of jeans had been spared as a symbol of a promise I'd made to myself to one day lose the weight again. Every now and then I got the jeans out, crossed every possible finger and toe, and attempted to defy the odds by putting them on. I pulled and tugged and lay down on the floor to try and stretch this denim that must have shrunk in the dryer. I knew in my head it was not a case of laundry gone bad, but my heart was living in denial. With my refusal to make changes in my unhealthy eating habits, the possibility of me ever wearing those jeans was nothing but wishful thinking. Until now. As I slipped the jeans on and buttoned them with ease, my smile could not be contained. I danced around my bedroom throwing my hands in the air. Victory, victory, sweet, sweet victory. I felt like I could take on the world. Until, just hours later, my world made me cry. A hurtful email, a disrespectful attitude from one of my kids, a missed appointment, a condemning feeling of irresponsibility, a messy house, a stressful situation at work, an unexpected bill, a dinner that was left basically untouched by my family, a spider in my tub. I found myself getting snappy with my family, irritated with the sender of the email, on edge about the mess and stress, frustrated by that bill, and mad that no one liked my dinner. So, by the time I found the spider in my one spot of relaxation, my emotions unraveled and frayed. How could I feel this way? I was wearing my skinny jeans, for heaven's sake. And I always thought, if only I could put on those skinny jeans, my whole world would fall into place and put a permanent smile on my face. Yet, here I was, just hours later, falling prey to the same topsy-turvy stuff I used to think wouldn't bother me if only I were smaller. This is the curse of the skinny jeans. My body size is not tied to my happy. If my happy was missing when I was larger, it will still be missing when I get smaller. Tying my happy to the wrong things. Tying my happy to the wrong things is partially what caused my weight gain in the first place. There were too many experiences I enjoyed primarily because of the food that was attached to them. The movies were tied to popcorn. A birthday party was tied to cake. A ball game was tied to a hot dog. School parties were tied to cookies. A morning meeting was tied to a gourmet coffee. Getting gas was tied to snack crackers and a soda. Watching TV was tied to chips. A summer outing was tied to ice cream. A winter outing was tied to hot chocolate. Tying my happy to food, skinny jeans, or anything else sets me up for failure. Not to mention that once I slip on the skinny jeans, My elation is quickly marred by the fear of gaining back the weight. And I'm not the only one who knows the curse of the skinny jeans. I once read an interesting commentary on this issue by Oprah. And while Oprah and I don't agree on some things, we can agree that tying our happy to the wrong things sets us up for failure every time. She said, I grew up believing that people with money didn't have problems, or certainly none that money couldn't solve. Then in 1986, my show went national. It changed the trajectory of my life. In 1992, I won another Emmy for Best Talk Show Host. She went on to say she'd prayed she wouldn't win because she was so embarrassed by her weight at the time. And 237 pounds was the heaviest I'd ever been. I had journals filled with prayers to God to help me conquer my weight demon. Oprah had everything she ever thought would make her happy. Money, fame, recognition, success beyond many of our wildest dreams. And at one point, thanks to a crazy liquid diet, she dropped down to 145 pounds and wore skinny jeans. I remember being a teenager at the time, glued to that day's show when the skinniest Oprah I'd ever seen revealed her new body. But none of that brought her lasting happiness. It may have brought her moments of temporary thrills, but waiting for her at home were those journals filled with prayers asking God to help her, even on the day she wore skinny jeans. Remain. I can totally relate. I have to learn to attach my happy to the only internal stability there is and remain there. Oh, the prayers I have prayed over and over and over for God to help me, stabilize me, and tie my happy only to Him. It's called learning to remain. Isaiah chapter 55 verses 8 through 12 illustrates so beautifully exactly what I'm talking about. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. As the rain and the snow come down from heaven, and do not return to it without watering the earth and making it bud and flourish, so that it yields seed for the sower and bread for eater, so is my word that goes out from my mouth. It will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it. You will go out in joy and be led forth in peace. Did you catch how satisfying God's words are? They are compared to water that makes the earth bud and flourish. That's why Jesus' words in John chapter 15 are so crucial for us to apply if we're ever going to have a lasting joy, whether or not we are wearing our skinny jeans. Here's how Jesus describes it. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Now remain in my love. If you obey my commands, you will remain in my love, just as I have obeyed my Father's commands and remain in his love. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. John chapter 15 verses 9 through 12. I'll admit, I've read these verses many times while nodding and saying, yeah, I've read this before. That's nice. But just recently, something new jumped out at me and begged me to park my brain in the truths I'd only been skimming. We are taught to remain in God's love so that we won't tie our happy to anything but God, so that our joy will be complete. Complete, as in not lacking anything. Complete, as in filled up to the brink with joy, no matter if we are wearing our skinny jeans or not. Complete, as in satisfied with a fullness we can't get any other way. Can you imagine how beautiful it would be to live as a complete person? Incomplete people are difficult, demanding, and always in pursuit of that next thing that will surely fill them. Incomplete people think that putting on their skinny jeans will right all the wrongs and fill up all their insecurities. Incomplete people quickly find out that their skinny jeans adjust nothing in their lives except the number on the tag no one else sees. Incomplete people are desperate for others to notice their diet progress, but quickly realize compliments don't assure connection or intimacy. They are not more liked or accepted or welcomed in. And even if they are being liked based on a smaller gene size, what an awfully shallow place to be. The bad news is, we're all incomplete people. The good news is, Jesus loves incomplete people, and he wants us to know we can have complete joy by being secure enough in his love to reach out and love other incomplete people. Afternoon acts of kindness. I'll admit, loving incomplete people doesn't seem like the obvious path to joy, and it doesn't seem like an obvious topic to be covered in a book on getting healthy and keeping our skinny jeans in proper perspective. But stick with me here, you might be surprised. Just the other day, I was pondering some of those distressing emails I mentioned earlier, and I reached the conclusion that incomplete people are a trigger that make me want to eat. They are complicated and sensitive and messy in their reactions. They have the potential to drain my resolve and make me grumpy. The last thing I want to do when a person throws their incompleteness in my direction is love them. I want to grab a bag of Cheetos and rationalize how much a treat is certainly in order right now. Then, I want to sit on my couch and tell the air around me how much I love Cheetos and how much I dislike incomplete people. But what if I dared in that moment to think differently? What if I could be courageous enough to act and react like a complete person? A Jesus girl who has his joy in her, sustaining her, and directing her. Instead of looking at this incomplete person's offense, what if I could see the hurt that surely must be behind their messy reaction? I pause. I don't reach for the Cheetos. I don't react harshly out of my own incompleteness. I don't wallow in my thoughts of how unfair and unkind this other person is. And I choose to love instead. Quietly, taking out a piece of stationery and responding with words of grace, or crafting an email with a message of compassion. Better yet, what if I were to do this every afternoon, even when I haven't had a run-in with an incomplete person, but am just simply craving things I shouldn't eat? I've been trying this out lately, and I love it. Afternoon acts of kindness are yet another unexpected but beautiful result of letting Jesus direct my healthy eating pursuits. Each day, I've been asking Jesus who in my life needs words of encouragement, and he always puts someone on my heart. So, instead of filling my afternoons with thoughts of frustration toward others or tempting thoughts about food, I am filling my afternoons with his thoughts of love toward others. And this is a great place to be, no matter if I'm wearing my skinny jeans or not. After all, remember, the ultimate goal of this journey isn't about making me a smaller-sized person, but rather making me crave Jesus and his truths as the ultimate filler of my heart. We are to remain in this healthy perspective. Let his thoughts be our thoughts. Remain. Let his ways be our ways. Remain. Let his truths go to the depths of our hearts and produce good things in our lives. Remain. Approach this world full of fellow incomplete people with the joy of Jesus. Remain. and see our skinny jeans as a fun reward, nothing more. Remain. And be led forth in peace, because I've kept my happy tied only to Jesus. Remain. Personal Reflections. 1. What fantasies do you have about what life would be like if you were at your ideal weight? Do you imagine everything in your life would somehow be better? Your relationships would improve? Your confidence would soar? Your problems would fall away? You'd be respected, admired, obeyed? Why do you think your weight has so much power to influence your outlook on life? 2. Movies and popcorn, parties and cake, ball games and hot dogs, meetings and coffee, TV and chips. What activities do you enjoy in part or primarily because of the food attached to them? Which activities might lose all attraction for you if food weren't part of the experience? 3. We are taught to remain in God's love so that we won't tie our happy to anything but God. Page 123. To what other things besides God have you tried to tie your happy? What was the result? Do you think it's possible for you to feel full of joy, even if you're not where you want to be with your weight? Why? Or why not? 4. Incomplete people are complicated and sensitive and messy in their reactions. Page 124. Who are the incomplete people in your life? Are these people triggers that make you want to eat? Are there ways in which you might be an incomplete person in someone else's life? For others as well as yourself, are you able to look beyond the incompleteness to the hurt that may be behind the messy reactions? What do you see? 5. Compassion for incomplete people, including ourselves, translates into acts of kindness. When you think of the incomplete people in your life, especially those who may be eating triggers, how might a compassionate act of kindness change how you feel about that person? How might it change how you feel about yourself and your own incompleteness? Chapter 13. Overindulgence. I didn't quite know what to think as my pastor walked up to the podium with a bottle of wine and proceeded to pour a glass. Just about everyone shifted in their seats while he let the shock of the moment settle in, really settle in. Seeing a bottle of wine on center stage in a Bible Belt church just doesn't happen. Ever. We drink grape juice for communion. He then asked us to stand for a reading of God's Word, which was the passage in John 2 where Jesus turns water into wine. The point of his sermon was to clear away some cultural debris, taboos about drinking wine, so that we could see what the Bible really says and accept it as part of the larger truth of God's Word. It was a mighty fine sermon, full of verses that dispelled the myths that the wine Jesus filled the water jars with that day was unfermented, watered-down grape juice. It was wine. Wine that Jesus himself, who never sinned, drank. Of course, he handled this teaching very delicately. Those who are underage or who have issues with alcohol and can't have a glass of wine without being irresponsible should avoid it altogether. He also touched on not being a stumbling block to those who struggle. But again, whether or not to have a glass of wine with dinner was not the point of the sermon. The point was to know what the Bible says about issues we face every day and to apply those scriptures to our lives appropriately. Then he shifted gears and turned his attention to food. Now this was really a historic church-going day. Seeing wine in the sanctuary was shocking enough, but never have I heard a preacher man talk about gluttony in church. Never. And his point was brilliant. How can we stand and wag our fingers in the direction of alcohol, only to walk into the church-wide covered dish buffet and stuff ourselves sick with fried, covered and smothered, grossly caloric delights that buckle our paper plates and cause our stomachs to cry for antacids. Overindulgence is overindulgence, and limitless indulgence in food always has consequences. It compromises our health, diminishes energy to pursue our calling, and affects the way we feel about ourselves, just to name a few. It's at this point that we have to admit our issues with food aren't just little things that require us to wear a larger than ideal dress size. Eating in excess is a sin. The Bible calls it gluttony, which is defined in the dictionary as excess in drinking or eating. The biblical teaching about excess drinking and eating is clear. Do not join those who drink too much wine or gorge themselves on meat, for drunkards and gluttons become poor, and drowsiness clothes them in rags. Proverbs chapter 23, verses 20 through 21. Here's another. He who keeps the law is a discerning son, but a companion of gluttons disgraces his father. Proverbs chapter 28, verse 7. I doubt we'll ever see either of these verses on the suggested memory verse for the week Sunday school bulletin board. They're hard verses. This is a hard topic. I imagine at this point you are wondering if we really need to go there with this gluttony thing. It's not exactly the most girlfriend fun topic that makes you say, "Preach on, sister, I'm loving this encouragement." And I doubt I'll be packing out any arenas if I ever decide to advertise a weekend conference on gluttony. But we have to go there, and let me tell you why. On the surface, it appears that all we're talking about is food and the amount we consume. In reality, there is a more serious issue at the root of gluttony. Overstuffing ourselves with food, or drinking until we get drunk, or getting wrapped up in the affections of an adulterous relationship are all the desperate attempts to silence the cries of a hungry soul. A soul longing to be filled. A starved soul is like the vacuum cleaner my mother used when I was a child. It had a long metal tube that ravenously sucked up anything and everything set before it. It sucked up dust bunnies with the same furor as a $10 bill. I know that one from experience. Our souls have the same ravenous intensity as my mother's vacuum cleaner. That's how God created us, with a longing to be filled. It's a longing God instilled to draw us into deep intimacy with Him. The psalmist expresses this longing as an intense thirst. As the deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When can I go and meet with God? Psalm chapter 42, verses 1 through 2. I spread out my hands to you. My soul thirsts for you like a parched land. Psalm chapter 143, verse 6. Indeed, our souls are thirsty and ravenous vacuums. If we fail to understand how to fill our souls with spiritual nourishment, we will forever be triggered to numb our longings with other temporary physical pleasures. When those pleasures are food, the resulting behavior is what we often hear referred to as emotional eating. But this issue is bigger than emotions. It's really about spiritual deprivation. My boyfriend breaks up with me. I want a tub of ice cream. That big business deal falls through. I'll take the supersized fries, please. I don't feel pretty. I need some chocolate to soothe and delight me. My kids are driving me crazy. I deserve a piece of cake. I deserve three pieces. I hate cleaning my house. When I'm done, I'll treat myself to as many chips as I want. It's my birthday, and I don't really think anyone cares. I'll just eat my way into happiness or numbness. Same difference, right? I hardly think it ironic that I'm struggling even as I write these words. There's a situation in my life that has wormed its way straight to the most vulnerable of places in my heart. This situation has made me feel hurt and rejected. Years ago, a little crack in my strong resolve was created by the extreme rejection of my biological father. And while I found amazing victory in understanding I'm no longer a child of a broken parent, but rather a child of God, revisiting rejection is never fun. We'll talk more about emotional emptiness in the next chapter. For now, let's focus on the triggers that come on hard days, days when part of me says, "Today is a day you deserve treats, Lisa. Just one day of eating whatever you want and as much as you want." But just because I've reached my goal weight in this journey and operate in a good place most of the time does not mean I can drop my guard and fall back into old habits. It's such a slippery slope. I'm not saying we shouldn't allow ourselves the occasional treat. We should. But I realized when the desire for treats is triggered by difficult emotions, it's not really a desire for treats. It's a thinly veiled attempt at self-medication. And self-medicating with food, even once, triggers vicious cycles I must avoid. It's also important to note that not all gluttony is caused by emotional responses. Sometimes it's just an overindulgence because we lack the self-control to say enough is enough. And it breaks my heart how much people in the church simply turn their heads the other way when it comes to this issue. So, what are we to do? A few years ago, the words portion control took on a new meaning as I studied the book of Exodus and noted the curious emotional response God's people had after Moses led them out of slavery in Egypt. They'd just seen God do miracle after miracle to help them escape their captors, but they panicked when it came to food. In the desert, the whole community grumbled against Moses and Aaron. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you have brought us out into this desert to starve this entire assembly to death." Then the Lord said to Moses, "I will rain down bread from heaven for you. The people are to go out each day and gather enough for that day. In this way, I will test them and see whether they will follow my instructions." Exodus chapter 16, verses 2-4. In other words, God planned to use the Israelites' food issues to teach them the valuable lesson of daily dependence on Him. Don't you love how applicable this is to us? Ancient Bible stories have taught me that history certainly has a way of repeating itself, so I'd be wise to pay attention. Because these recently freed Israelites continued to grumble against God and turn their hearts from Him, God took them on a 40-year detour. Instead of heading straight to the promised land of freedom, they had to wander in the desert for 40 years while they learned how to truly depend on God. I don't know about you, but I don't want to spend the next 40 years of my life learning this lesson. I want to stop grumbling about my weight, apply this valuable training about God dependence and portion control, and keep walking toward the victory that can be mine. So, how did God teach His ancient people to depend on Him daily? Each day the Israelites were to ask God for their portion of food. Then God would rain down exactly what they needed for nourishment. It was called manna, which I imagine was something like little sweet potato flakes. The Israelites were to go out each day and collect just enough manna for that one day. They were never to gather up extra and build big storehouses of manna supplies where they could set up drive-through windows for McManna Happy Meals. No, God wanted them to take only their portion for one day. The next day they would come to Him and again receive their daily portion. The only exception to this was the day before Sabbath when they could gather a double portion so they wouldn't have to work on the holy day. It was a process intended to put them in the habit of dependence on God, and only God, each day. We would do well to apply this same process to our struggles.